G'day friends, and welcome back to Happy Days. This is your pal Jesse on the mic, welcoming you back for another awesome show, proudly brought to you by my very own Freak Productions. If you want to support my creative journey of writing novels and comic books, go to www.freekproductions.com, check out my stuff on there, or you can even leave a donation. A crisp high five will get you a virtual high five from me for sure. And your support is most appreciated. Thanks to each and every single one of you that continue to listen to the show. It's amazing to have people come back and listen to the show week after week. I appreciate the support immensely. As I say, week in, week out, I don't expect to listen, to have thousands of listeners. I really don't. I just look more to make an impact in people's days and trains of thought. So, you know, if we can achieve that together, then we're kicking goals. This episode is a good one. I'm really pumped about this one. After a little bit of technical difficulties putting the first episode together, we're now back on track. So this is a great episode. I'm talking to a guy that's very near and dear to my heart, Gino Lunardo. Many of you probably know him from the band Filter. He was also in the band Device with Dave Draymond of Disturbed. He's an exceptional guitarist and a brilliant producer, but he's more importantly just an amazing human being. And we have a great chat about, you know, being the youngest of seven kids growing up in a rock and roll house, of the sounds of the Rolling Stones versus the Beatles blasting away, through to humble beginnings, learning the ropes of industrial music with Paul Barker and Al Jorgensen of Ministry, being front seat, checking out the magic that went into what would be one of Ministry's greatest albums, Psalm 69, through to, you know, getting in with his first band, Chem Lab, which led to his work in Filter and beyond. He continues producing today, working with bands, but he also does a lot of soundtrack work. A lot of his stuff's been on Netflix, movies like Peppermint with Jennifer Garner, video games like Cyberpunk 2077, and the list goes on. And he's just such a humble, well-spoken guy, and we have a great conversation. We talk about new projects and current projects that he's working on, including a very important fundraising single that he worked with members of Rammstein and Ministry on, called a cover of Come Together, which is raising money for Ukrainian relief with UNICEF. It's a great in-depth conversation, and there's a lot of fun in there. We talk about Vegemite. It's all sexual dynamite. And without further ado, here is my conversation with Gino Lunardo here on Happy Days. Please enjoy. All right, mate. Thank you, Gino, for taking the time to share your Happy Days with me again, my friend. And it's an absolute pleasure.
Oh, man. Thank you.
Yeah, dude.
Great talking with you.
Yeah, I'm feeling a sense of deja vu. I feel like we've done this before, but I just can't put my finger on it, you know?
We definitely have.
Yeah, I feel like I had a dream about this or something. I don't know, man. It was amazing. But anywho, dude, so you're obviously keeping very busy. Life's good. Studio's busier than ever. And you've got a new studio now, so I'd love to hear about it.
Yeah, it's the Mix Room North. There's a mix room where we did a lot of records, you know, basically those two and three, you know, so title of record and the amalgam one. We did them at the Mix Room in Burbank with Ben Gross. Ben opened up this new place and invited me to come down, and now I have a room here, and there's two other amazing rooms, and it's just, you know, It's a killer place.
Yeah.
We get a lot of good stuff going on.
Yeah, those photos you've sent me are just incredible, man. It looks so cool.
I mean, the live room, the big difference is the mix room in Burbank has no live room. I mean, we used to record drums in the hall, but now we're recording drums in this, you know, massive, you know, live room with 18-foot ceilings and a, you know, an incredible mic locker and 80-channel SSL with all the, you know, the everything. We got the whole thing going on.
That's awesome. You know, say you said recording drums in the hall. That for some reason that just triggered a memory when I was reading Led Zeppelin's book Hammer of the Gods about when they recorded John Bonham's drums in the stairwell of a frigging castle. I mean, it sort of sounds a little bit weird like that. Have you done something weird to that effect?
We have. I mean, we tried the kit in a lot of different places, you know, inside the room until you find the sweet spot. And then we have microphones in all four corners of the room that are way up. So it's 18-foot ceilings. So they're about 14 to 16 feet up in the air.
Yeah.
It definitely gives you a different room sound. You know, because with drums, the room sound is everything. You know.
Yeah, it does. And it makes a difference in the final product. I mean, those two albums that you mentioned, Title of Record and The Amalgamate, the friggin' drum sounds on those just epic, man. Like, some of my favorite drum production, actually.
We did those at East West Studios. But we had, you know, that we were spoiled back in the day when you had a budget. You could get the drum doctor. The drum doctor would come in with like 14 different snares. And, you know, he'd tune everything. And, you know, and then Ben just, you know, dialed it in. And then it was just up to getting the great takes.
Yeah. And like with your setup today, with recording today, like a lot of the experience that you've had over the years with your projects that you've been a part of as well, how much of that have you sort of taken into the way you approach working with artists today?
Oh man, I mean it's all been a build up. You know, you just want to get the best thing for the song. So, I mean, I incorporated all of that. I mean, it just depends on the material, you know, if it's electronic stuff, obviously we're working with samples and, a lot of bands are in budget, you know, like today. So it's, you have to, you know, use something else, you know, to get that. And there's a lot of great stuff out there. And, you know, the Stephen Slate stuff's awesome. Get Good Drums is another great one. You know, so at least for demos, you know, I mean, if you have an endless budget, you can go into rooms like this and do it. But a lot of these guys, you know, a lot of the up and comers are trying to just get their songs out there. So you got to measure that, you know, how's that going to work within the budget?
Yeah. I like how you touched on the material, you know, as a songwriter myself, you know, I find that, you know, a lot of bands today, they have all the tricks of the trade. They've got all the fancy equipment, all the wonderful programs and stuff, but they don't know how to write a good song. And I think that is so paramount, you know, and I'm sure you can attest to that as well with your track record. I'd love to talk about the importance of material with you, like having the right songs.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, there's choosing the songs and then there's the other element of serving the song.
Yeah.
So you have to have people that are willing to serve the song and they you know, cause people have different views on that. But I mean, it, you know, after all is said and done, you know, the song is the most important thing.
Yeah.
So it's like, I don't need to have a solo on every frickin' song I do. You know, I just need the sonics to be great and it needs to tell a story, you know? Yeah. So, that's what I look for when people send me demos and stuff. I'm like, I'm looking for a story. I'm looking for something compelling.
Yeah. Cause, do you subscribe to the KISS theory? Like keep it simple, stupid.
I do. Yeah. I do. Same. Yeah. Yeah. And it goes to that whole less is more thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, but even within less is more, there's some very sophisticated stuff going on. I mean, if you like listen to the Police, you know,
yes.
It's like, okay, you know, three piece, we're keeping it simple, but man, and you know, Sting's bass lines, but his counterpoint between his vocal and the bass line and then Stuart Copeland's amazing work on the drums. Oh, yeah. You know,
so good.
And Andy Summers just providing this other level of texture and harmony and sophistication. You know, he's one of my great like inspirations, definitely on guitar. I mean, there's like Robert Smith, The Edge, and Andy Summers are like my first. And then I got into heavier, you know, really started getting into heavier stuff. But like originally I was like a kid with a delay pedal. And I was I sound like I can actually do something.
That's so cool.
I still kind of do that.
Yeah. It's kind of fun when you play around and you hear sounds and you go, oh wow, I like that one. Yeah.
Yeah, because that sound can lead you to another texture and lead you to the bridge or lead you to a big thing. Like, you know, the second verse, there's always like if you listen to filter songs, there's always like a little developmental part within that thing. And it's a very common arrangement trick, but you got to find your own, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I love that you mentioned that, but also you mentioned three amazing influences in your life. And I think, wow, what a great way to sort of grow up, you know, musically with heroes like that. You know, the importance of heroes is it's so huge. Like
I had like the Cure pornography tape, you know, like the little cassette.
Yeah.
And then I had Regatta de Blanc, and then like when Unforgettable Fire came out, that just whatever, all bets were off. I was like, I'm totally into this. I'm totally into doing music for my life.
Yeah. And like, was it the shape of the songs, or was it like the tones of the guitars and that really drew you into that world?
Yeah, it was like all those guys have like a certain hyper-emotionalism that attracted me.
Yeah.
And so it was the song for sure, like the story and all that. But then the way that they shaped it, I mean, the way that Robert Smith uses a flanger and the way that the Edge uses the delay, you know, and then the same thing with Andy Summers, you know, his effects work, you know, it just complemented the song.
Yeah.
So we're back to serving the song.
I love it. Yeah, I love it how it all comes full circle. It's a beautiful thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sexual dynamite.
Sexual dynamite. Here we are back.
Back in live.
All I'm right. John Madden.
I can't talk. Well, all right,
so we've tried this, we previously tried this, but now we've got good audio.
Yeah, now it's great.
We can talk. We can tell the story.
The story is good.
In a musical world. I'll do it like a trailer.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
In a world.
In a world of music and sound.
Where from Gino Rich and David Draymond play racquetball.
All just that. Kidding. Did you do that?
No, we never did.
I was going to say it, man, because the visual of Dave Draymond playing racquetball, I would pay to see that. That'd be awesome.
Oh, dude, and his white shorts and his white eyes on. Yeah. Oh, dude, it's epic.
Oh, dude. Yeah. Okay.
No, I'm just over here. It's weird. It's so weird. I have a Vegemite sandwich next to me when I'm talking to you, Jesse.
Are you for real?
No.
Ah.
What is Vegemite, by the way?
All right. Let's.
I want to clear this up for listeners because I never really got the full deal.
So Vegemite is like an Australian delicacy, man. I don't know.
It's like haggis for Australians.
Haggis. I don't know, man. Haggis, peanut, haggis peanut from butter. And, yeah, yeah. Or haggis, peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. You know, I still don't understand that fascination. But I mean, were you
cheap food for kids?
Yeah, were you a PBJ? America. You were a PBJ kid?
Done some bologna sandwiches and, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I okay. Mean. Yeah, that makes sense. But Vegemite is like, yeah, I mean, you it was very rare not to start a morning without Vegemite on toast. You know, it was just like
right on.
It's a very yeasty flavored spread like that butter. You put on you. Yeah, essentially. But that's the secret. A lot of a lot of my American friends made the mistake of just putting the Vegemite on very heavy-handed without putting enough butter on it, and that's where the mistake happens. Yeah, and
okay.
They go, oh, it's so bitter, and you know, it's like, dude, no. You've got to have your ratio of butter and Vegemite right.
I like the ratio thing.
Yeah,
I'm looking at my compressor right now. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking ratios.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Mm,
food,
yeah.
Ratios.
Food ratios. Yeah, so that
might
everything.
Be my new. That's going to be my new podcast. Food ratios.
I like that. That sounds cool.
Sign or peaches up. And puppies. I don't peaches know. I and like puppies. Peaches and puppies. It's got good alliteration. I don't know.
Yeah, that sounds cool. Yeah.
All right, so we're gonna have some fun here talking about some stuff.
Yeah, dude. Yeah, man. Yeah, absolutely. Hey, with Vegemite sandwiches too, you can put anything you want on it. And I went the next level, and I used Vegemite in all my cooking. So I chuck it in stir fries, I chuck it in, you name it, I put it in there. So,
oh, right on.
Yeah, so there you go.
I'm assuming it's very nutritional.
Very, very. It's got, okay. If you get the good jars, it's got a lot of B12 in it, so it's got everything you need.
There you go.
But yeah, anyway. So, yeah, man, let's get into the happiness.
Yeah, this is kind of like 2.0. Like, we had some audio problems, you know. On the first try, but let's do it.
Yeah,
I'm here. I'm ready to talk to you.
We're ready to do this. From the makers of Toy Story and Aliens comes absolutely nothing relevant.
Absolutely nothing.
But it comes in a form of sexual dynamite.
Yes, with a little Vegemite thrown in.
And peaches and puppies. Peaches living and harmoniously. Puppies. Yes. Absolutely. So, yeah, growing up, man, not that we've grown up any better, but, yeah, man, tell me a little bit about, growing up in the world of Geno as a kid, man. Like you grew up in a big house, lots of music, you know,
lots of music. Well, I mean, I was the youngest of seven. So, you know, we grew up outside of Chicago. My dad was a doctor. My mom was an RN. So it was kind of like, my older brothers and sisters, I was the youngest, taking care of me. And they were playing a lot of music. I mean, there's definitely like a cool Beatles versus Stones war going on.
Yeah, cool.
You know, there. And so a lot of Beatles, a lot of Stones. And then when my sister went to LA, she went to USC and she started bringing home like the Cars and Missing Persons.
Yeah.
And the freaking Motels. Those records started blowing my mind. I was like, wow, these sounds are so cool. And then it was like, got into Gary Newman and all sorts of fun stuff. It was like, I kind of like started there. And then when I got into high school, my first 2 years, I went, and I didn't tell you this on the last time we did this run. I went to this Dead Poets Society kind of place where you had to like wear a jacket and a tie every day. And it's called La Lumiere. It's in LaPorte, Indiana. And I felt very repressed, but I actually got my first bass, my first instrument I got from a roommate there. And that was like, you know, I was learning just like U2 riffs, you know, like on bass. And then by my second year, I became kind of disenfranchised. And a buddy of mine, this guy Doug Spinoza, has been in a bunch of stuff. He's like, why don't you come to my school? And I'm like, what's your school? And it's like, the Chicago Academy for the Arts. And I'm like, okay, what is that? And I applied. I actually applied. This is a hilarious story. As an actor.
Okay? Oh, wow.
So I had to go do an audition. But during the audition, one of the things they ask you to do is sing two songs. And I was like, what the hell songs do I know? So I did Green Acres. Green Acres is the place to be. And then I got up on a, I stood up. There's a panel, like there's like five people in front of you, just like flash dance, you know?
Yeah.
And I got up on the main guy's desk and I did Roxanne
no.
in the worst way.
Oh, oh yeah. Yes.
And I was like, all right, am I in? And, you know, so yeah, they took me. I was terrible. I sucked. But the school was divided up into four floors. So when you walked into the first floor, it was the art department.
Right.
It was the people doing studying art. And then as it went up, it went through the other disciplines. And the third floor, so the acting floor was on the fourth floor. So I would always go through the third floor, which was the music department. And I was like blown away. Yeah. There's like guys sitting around playing amazing stuff. I mean, God, it was just like, and I'm like, I'd like to do that.
Yeah. Know? Yeah. Yeah.
And so I talked to the head of that department, this guy, Dr. Bruce Horst. And, he's like, why don't you just, you know, come and like do a dual kind of thing, like keep going with the acting stuff, but like come to classes. He's the guy that actually ended up writing my letter of recommendation to Berklee College of Music. So from there in high school, I went to Berklee and met a lot of great people, learned a lot of great stuff. You know, I was in the music, they called it MP&E back then. Now they call it the music technology,
right?
Whatever, because it involves both the synth department. We had a separate synth department and then we had the studios. So yeah, it was from there. You know, I went through all that stuff. And then when I graduated, they were like, well, where are you going to go? And I was like, oh, man, opened Land of Rape and Honey with Ministry. And at 3347 North Halsted, I'm like, I'm going to what these guys are doing.
Yeah.
So I went over there and I ended up at Trax. And this is right when Ministry was making Psalm 69. They had just come off of Mind is a Terrible Thing to Taste, and which I loved.
Yeah, great album.
And I just got, I was an assistant. So I got stuck like, what were those huge silver movie discs? Do you remember those things? Like laser discs?
Laser discs, I think they were.
Yeah, laser yeah. discs. Yeah, yeah, I get sat out in the room with an Akai sampler and a laser disc machine, and I'd have to sample movie quotes and movie rhythms and shit like that. And, yeah, so I worked on Psalm 69. I didn't play on it, but I because at that point, I wasn't really playing on records, but I was working on them and I was learning a lot of great stuff.
Yeah.
And then a band called Chem Lab came in, and Chem Lab was from New York. They're very like Nails industrial style, mm-hmm. and I worked on their record with Jeff Critter Newell, who's an amazing engineer who unfortunately passed away, but Critter was like, he's legend at Trax.
Yeah.
So basically from there, just to keep this moving along, like, Chem Lab asked me out on tour and I was out playing on tour with them. But I was going through like a Zoom 9050 or no, it was a 9030. And I was just into the front of house.
Mm.
And the keyboard player, Dylan, was like, dude, get out from behind me. It was kind of like this Rod Stewart story. Like if you've ever heard that urban legend where Rod was just getting hammered behind the 412s before he could go out and sing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I went out and I believe it was at the Fantasy in Pittsburgh. If I can, you know, if my
very cool
soggy brain can remember, you know, I went out and I stepped on that monitor. I put my right foot up on the monitor and that, you know, in front of that crowd. And then that just blew the whole thing.
This is what I'm going to do
from here on out. And from there, it went into the Filter days. You know, that's, I think so it was cool. Right around 95.
Yeah.
And Brian Liesking had a lot to do with that. Brian was a huge part of bringing me into Filter. Him and Rich had been in Nine Inch Nails. And they left Nails to start Filter, and they had done the first record, Short Bus, in Rocky River, Ohio. But like Brian was always in Trax. He was a Chicago guy.
Yeah.
So he convinced Richie to move the band to Chicago. Okay. So there we were. And then I you know, I auditioned for the band and ended up, you know, getting it. And then we were 2 weeks out from the first tour and we didn't have a drummer. And it was just like this insane amount of auditioning. And Matt Walker ended up killing it, who now plays for Morrissey, but he played for Pumpkins and Garbage and so many other things. And he has incredible, like his solo stuff now is just, it's pimping.
He's a killer drummer.
He is. He is. He's amazing.
Yeah.
So, we went on, you know, then we went out on tour and then the Pumpkins took us out on the Melancholy tour. And it just kind of went on and on from there. And then Brian left. And so for the second record, title record, it was kind of like Rich and I, and Frank was there, but then we got a new drummer, Steve Gillis, and Steve did a great, amazing job.
Yeah, he's but another great drummer too.
Yeah, yeah. So, so it just kind of progressed from there. And then after, you know, title record, there was the Amalgamut, and did the Amalgamut, and then Rich had to go get well. And I just like went off on this other thing and started scoring film and, you know, just kind of like going out on my own, like producing other things and writing other songs, you know. And I tried another band called South of Earth, and I wrote this great song, I'm Not Jesus, that Apocalyptica actually ended up picking up. And Corey Taylor from Slipknot sang on it. And
yeah.
You know, very, very proud of that stuff.
Yeah, that's a great song, man.
Thanks.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites. I love it.
My folks being Catholic didn't like it. They're what the hell is this? You know, but it was
what are you doing?
We were way ahead of the curve though on the whole child abuse, you know, in the Catholic Church scandal.
Yeah.
And they just, you know, they were very diligent Catholics and you know, I respect that completely. You know, my dad went to church every day, but there was definitely a problem there. And you know, you use your voice as an artist to, you know, point these things out and speak to things. So that takes me to Post Filter, you know.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive story, man. And like, if we can back it, I'm still sort of like wrap my head around that part with Ministry when you were learning the ropes still, and you're sitting out in the studio with you know an Akai sampler and Laserdisc player as well, recording samples. So is there truth in the fact that a lot of those samples on that Psalm 69 record, there's a lot of stuff that you contributed and you know, had to find those samples?
I don't know. I don't know what I'll actually use, like, I can't pick one particular thing. You know, like if you look at like Thieves on Mind is a Terrible Thing to Taste, you obviously hear "Get up, get on your feet," you know, from Stanley Kubrick's film, you know, Full Metal Jacket. I don't know if, you know, I don't know what he used, because they were all mapped out on a keyboard. Every key had a different sample on it. He would just do his thing.
Yeah.
And then he, you know, they would tweak it, you know, kind of lo-fi it out against the vocal.
Yeah.
But no claim to fame.
No, that's okay.
I definitely sat there with Paul Barker and helped mix Corrosion.
Yeah.
You know, and stuff like that. But I mean, the main thing was learning from those guys. They're total sweethearts.
Yeah.
And, I mean, they have this like really rough exterior and scary exterior, but really they're just awesome people.
I've heard
like
that.
Paul and Al are great. And Al's kicking ass right now. I mean,
he is, tour, isn't he? He's great.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, he's back like
firing 3,000%.
Yes, yeah, he is. Dude.
I remember seeing them on tour a few years back and just at Soundwave Festival and just watching that show and just for the first time, and it just blew my mind through the stratosphere, and I just went, I can't watch anything after this. This is it, you know. Like, that's just the level of showmanship and musicianship that goes into what they do. Is just, I don't know. I find few bands can touch what they do.
Dude, it's like now it's better than. I mean, okay, so I obviously listen to Twitch and even with Sympathy back when I was in high school. But
yeah,
I saw him in college at the Channel in Boston, which is a very famous venue.
Wow. Okay.
And he had a bat. He had this thing on his forehead with a bat and a bottle of Johnny Walker, and he was drinking while he's, you know, the. And now he's way more on point, you know.
Yeah.
Like, he's just like, but I mean, to think about all the amazing stuff he's done. I mean, he essentially created a genre that helped, and I think Trent would agree with this, and a lot of us that make this, you know, style of music.
Yeah.
He created that template that Trent took, and then Trent, you know, went into a more song driven thing instead of just complete chaos. With the, you know, this, you know, he still used distorted vocals and stuff, but mm-hmm. you know, Trent's such an amazing writer. He just went on and on and on and on. It grew into a, you know, what it is now. Thing.
It's impressive.
And it's nice to see Al back, like, kicking ass.
It's great, isn't it? I mean, I guess I like in, yeah, sorry to go off topic a bit, but like Al Jorgensen, I look at him like kind of like the Mick Jagger of industrial, man. He just doesn't stop, man.
He just keeps and going. And you know, I mean, it's believe inspiring. Me, there are times when I thought we were going to lose him, you know, and he just keeps going. And, you know, it's a niche thing, you know, now in this market, you know, it's tough for.
Yeah.
That kind of music, but there's still rabid fans out there that want to hear that, and they want to go and experience that show.
Yeah,
because the show is a whole different thing from the record. You know, it's like, it's great.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many questions in everything you've just said that I want to ask you. So we'll try and get through it as best as we can because you've got my brain going now. But like,
okay.
So, like, you know, with the ministry thing, I guess what I was sort of more leaning towards with the question was more about how much of an impact that had with where you wanted to go with your direction as an artist and producer. Because, I mean, you know, working with, you know, next to guys like Paul Barker and Al Jorgensen, I can only imagine that would just have such a profound effect.
So I came from the ministry camp, and Rich, you know, when we did Filter,
yeah,
you know, he's from the Nails camp, you know.
Yeah.
But the thing is, we just wanted to focus on songwriting.
Yeah,
you know, we used to have this big thing in the studio, like SONG, like, you know, and serving the song was the primary thing, you know.
Yeah.
You know, we did super hard stuff, and then we did Take a Picture, which is like an acoustic, like,
I mean, that is that's crazy.
It was
a wild
spectrum, you know.
Yeah,
what you can do, you know, within the thing.
And yeah,
it still had Richie's amazing voice screaming like, "Hey, Dad, what do you think about me now?" with that
yeah, it was
internal brilliant. Distortion box that he has.
Yeah.
But I think that we definitely went in a, you know, it was definitely more commercial in an aspect.
Yeah.
But it was still had integrity. It still had integrity. We knew where we came from, but we were just trying everything.
Yeah.
I mean, title of the record, you know, if you look at Short Bus, that's the black and white record. That's the black and white film. And it's got amazing, incredible stuff on it, and Brian Leeskind did a great job on it. Ben Gross mixed that one too.
Yeah.
And then we get to title of the record, and we're like, all right, we had built a new studio, and we had like the opportunity to just try everything in the kitchen sink, you know, like throw in everything in the kitchen sink. I mean, I remember putting a little Marshall, you know, those little Marshall amps, toy ones.
Yes.
Oh my God. I remember putting that in the oven with an SM57 mic on it and doing guitar parts that way. You know, it's like we did all sorts of weird experimental stuff. That was our experimental.
That alone tops Bob Marlette's story about recording John Five's guitars for the 2 record, setting up Marshalls on the washing machine just to
get this nice vibration. I can't remember the story exact, but it was pretty cool. But microphone.
Yeah, I mean, it's like if you watch the film Bohemian Rhapsody, where they're swinging the amp.
Yes.
You know, it's like, guys, just use a phaser.
So that would definitely be your Bohemian Rhapsody moment for sure.
Well, it was a very experimental time.
Yeah.
You know, and we kind of like, you know, we'd get like 50-year-old moms coming with their kids to the shows to hear, take a picture. And then we'd open with like, Welcome to the Fold and tear their dress off. And they'd be like, oh my God, what the hell is this? Shit, you know,
and that does come in for Murderous Thump. I love it. That's one of the best opening tracks on an album I've ever heard, man. It's just such a ferocious guitar sound,
man. And we used to joke about the little tom flap before the thing.
Because
we recorded it in Chicago and then we recorded it out here with Ben, but like it's like Chicago, dun, 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 you know, like.
That's gold, man. That's gold. There's so many questions coming out in my brain right now. But
Keep rolling, man. I got stories for days.
Yeah, but that, you know, when you mentioned about the 50-year-old mums bringing their kids to here take a picture, it kind of makes me think about Kiss, you know, like when at the height of their fame in the 70s when they were like, you know, they had all this back catalogue of Black Diamond, 100,000 Years and all that, but people wanted to hear I Was Made for Loving You, you know? Did you feel that kind of pressure, you and Rich and the guys at that time, like, you know, with Take a Picture taken off the way it did? Did you feel like a sort of a sense of pressure live?
No, we pulled it off live just fine. But I think that it was so not our hard side.
Yeah.
That it was, you know, but, you know, to be honest with you, I mean, it really kept the lights on, you know, with the band, absolutely. You know, it's like that's the biggest record the band's had, you know, is title of record, and it left us to make and play other songs like The Best Things. I love The Best Things.
Oh, love that track so much.
And Skinny, I'm very proud of Skinny. That was a weird track that I wrote in a Zeppelin-esque kind of way. If you listen to the voicings, but it also had The Cure in there. If you listen to the opening melodic line, it's very much like A Forest by The Cure.
Yeah, I love it.
And it was just a time that we got to experiment, you know, and Take a Picture, you know, blew us off the fucking charts, you know, like we had the flexibility and stuff to like do all the other eccentric stuff that we wanted to do. So it's, you know, it's double-edged sword.
Yeah, it
you
is
know? you got some people who are like, oh man, they just totally, you know, fuck their style, you know, from Short Bus. And then you got people, you know, it's introducing us to a larger audience, and that gives you flexibility to create.
Yeah, absolutely. When you mentioned The Best Things, because that's, yeah, I love that song. I love the bridge between, I don't know, a commercial flavor, but still maintaining that solid sonic impact that the Filter sound is so well known for. Shooting the film clip for that, because I mean, you did quite a few film clips during that period. How was that whole process for you as a musician, jumping in front of a camera? Was it a natural
thing? Oh, you mean the video? The video, like Kirsten Dunst is in that freaking video. Fred Ward, the amazing actor, is in that video. I was like, I'm all for this shit. And we got to drive huge muscle cars like out in the desert. The one thing, the one part that was a little scary, I'll tell you. So we had an assistant director in the back seat of the car when Rich and I are driving, and he like looks over at me and I'm whatever. That's intercut with the girl in the back seat. But we were doing a shot where a helicopter with a gyro cam is flying straight at us. And then we've got both cars on either side, and Rich was driving. I was a little nervous about that shot.
He's a bit of a lead foot.
Well, But the thing is, you have to keep a constant pace
right.
to get the shot. And yeah. I was just hoping, I'm like, Rich, just listen to the AD. He's back there with a walkie-talkie, like underneath the seat in the back seat. And this fucking helicopter's flying right at you. And you're like, okay, this could go horribly wrong. And also, like, you could reach out and touch the other cars. They were so close. The stunt driver car, yeah. you know, like the guys next to you. But, like, Rich was driving. So I'm like, okay, here we go. it all might end badly right now. And thank God it didn't. And
yeah.
they were so cool. It was cool shooting out in the desert. And I remember we wrecked the rental car because we went out and did the same moves that we did in the muscle cars, of like doing spin outs. And,
yeah, yeah.
and the whole car was full of dust. I remember returning that car and just like, here you go. We got insurance.
Yeah. And they're probably looking at you dumbfounded, like, big weekend.
But no, all the videos, like the take a picture video, welcome to the fold, like those, we had a lot of great people supporting us.
Yeah.
To make those. And, especially the directors of each of those. And, but their teams, you know, it was fun, man. It was like unbelievable. Now you got to shoot a music video on your iPhone.
Yeah, it's kind of weird, like, that whole process today versus, you know, back then. It's, like, I mean, looking at take a picture, just, yeah, the cinematography on that's just beautiful. Like, you know, I love the shots of, you know, Richard singing with you on the stairs, playing the guitar, and it just,
yeah,
it just looks amazing on camera. It's, that would have been a real treat to shoot that.
That was a very expensive video.
Yeah, it looks like
big budget. It was like a 3-day shoot. You know, we shot on the Universal lot where they did Apollo 13, cool. like yeah. the water stuff around the house. It was like unbelievable. We had to actually go through scuba training at the hotel. Damn. To like, yeah, the guy who worked with Schwarzenegger on True Lies,
mm-hmm.
he came over to the Sunset Marquee and we got tanks and went in the water and they had a lot of, you know, there's a lot of safety stuff that goes into doing that kind of stuff when, you know, the underwater shoot.
Because then
the next shot, when you see everybody, it's at the, I believe it was the USC Olympic pool. And they had lowered the entire, like, that whole house that was on the first shot.
Yeah.
They had it on a crane. And they lowered it with Rich and I and Jamie King into the water. And so they had a crane cam going into the thing. And then, but if that cable snapped, we'd be trapped against a wall. So they had like underneath the couches and stuff, they have like those, they look like a aluminum bottle with the mouthpiece, you know, of oxygen.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then they had guys ready to like cut through the wall, the other walls to like come in and get us and save us. It was pretty intense.
But stuff. What an experience, man. Like, I mean, you know, 1 minute you're in the studio making the music and next minute you're in a big tank with, you know,
yeah,
exactly. The cameras in your face and stuff. I don't know, man. That's kind of
exactly.
surreal. Yeah.
No, it was pretty surreal. Good stuff though.
Yeah, man. And like, as a producer, like making the transition from studio to the live stage, how was that for you? Like, you know, cause you take a lot of pride in the way things sound and the sonic approach to everything. Emulating that on stage live, did you have a big part in how that all came together? Like,
I helped our drummers. Like, we had Triggers,
yeah,
you know, the Polecats or whatever. Like, we used many different things,
yeah,
but you know, yeah, I certainly wanted it to sound as close as it could, but then again, it's live.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
There were times, you know, we did a Molson beer show up in Newfoundland in Canada, mm-hmm. and we had to play with other equipment that, you know, yeah. like I didn't have my setup like normally on tour. I just had to play through a dual rectifier with a 412, and that's it. You bring your wah pedal, you bring a delay pedal, and that's it.
Yeah,
you just go. I mean, you got to count on the music being the main thing, you know.
Well, that's it.
And we had written good songs, and Richie's, you know, the drummer was amazing. You know, Frank on bass.
Yeah, Yeah.
I was going to hold down the fort, and I knew Rich's voice, you know, it's like, you know, he comes from a very real Midwestern Cleveland, like punk rock attitude, yeah. You know, so he doesn't need like a, you know, a lot of processing and stuff. It's kind of, it's already there. So I didn't worry about it too much. People didn't seem to be disappointed.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing about the style of particularly this style of music, you know, capturing it live, you know, a lot of bands make that mistake. They do all the bells and whistles in the studio, but then bringing it out live, it's such a process.
Yeah. But the old school thing is throw and go. I mean, yeah. we did a bunch in Europe, you know, it's like a throw and go.
Yeah.
You just go up and play your ass off and do what you can and engage the audience.
Yeah.
Make them feel included and it's good. They get it.
That's it.
They're not going to worry about like whether the reverb's right or the delay's right or whatever.
I mean, I totally agree with what you're saying about the material. I mean, if you've got if the songs are there, everything should fall into place. I mean, fuck, I remember playing in Manchester in England, playing through a practice PA setup that you'd find in a rehearsal space, you know, and I'm just like, oh, okay, is this the PA? And the guy's like, yep. And making it work, you know, because you knew the songs deliver the goods. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Material is everything.
It is. It is. And in the new studio, like when I have bands in, you know, luckily I had a band, Away to Eli, here last week, and now I'm working with Velvet Chains. And it's just like, you know, they're in Vegas. I mean, the guys from Awaiting Eli like came from Kansas to like come here. But the thing is, it made all the difference, you know, when I'm doing vocals and we're working on lyric and we're working on tone, you know, it's just, you know,
it's, I mean, sexual dynamite. You
know, it is sexual dynamite. I think that came from our last interview.
You
were talking about the Device record and Glenn Hughes. Glenn is just tracking bass today. Again.
Oh, no way. The Dead Daisies? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Dead Daisies record. The new one that Ben is doing. And it's such a pleasure to walk in and, like, hear that shit. And, like, you know. And so it's just, you know, but having him on the Device record, you know, was special. I mean, David brought in a lot of different. We had Tom Morello on that record.
M Shadows.
Lizzie Hale.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Dude. that voice is she's got a set of pipes on her.
Yeah. Oh no. Yeah. It was amazing. Yeah. And that's a great cover. The Ozzy track with Lita Ford. Was it Lita?
Yeah, Lita Ford. Yeah.
Yeah. She did that.
Whose idea was that?
That was David's. But I got to tell you, so I was doing all the music.
Yeah.
And I did a first try on. You know, before I did all the reverse guitar stuff that you hear on the album now, I was just playing it straight. And I was like, and then I just started like playing guitar parts and reversing them. And it turned into that kind of gooey, cool vibe. And then that led them to both just do a different vocal, you know, like that one was one of the tougher ones. Covers can be tough, you know, because you don't want
absolutely, you know,
everybody's got their concept of what the song is in their mind already.
Yeah.
And then you gotta somehow reinvent that. And that was a beast for me. I'm just saying personally, like musically, like trying to get it right. So it didn't, you know, I was trying to do it like, I'll be honest. I started doing that thing. I had written this bass line that was kind of like Mercy Street by Peter Gabriel.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Do, 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 boom. You know, like all that. And David came in. He's like, what the hell is going on here? And I'm like, all right. Let me start over on this one. So the next day I gave him the what you hear now. And he was like, all right, this is, here we go. But it was not... that was not one of the easier ones. You know, all the original stuff was pretty easy.
Yeah.
But doing the covers, and then we did a Nails cover, and that was, for me, it was tough. Like, I, you know, it was up tempoed from what Trent had originally done. Because when I did it in the original tempo, I was like, this is not captivating. This isn't like right on point. But it ended up fucking great. I mean, that record was a very interesting record, you know.
Oh, I think it's a sonic masterpiece, man. It's just so many, like, musically, I mean,
Well, I gotta give credit to David. He invited me down to his house. We had done a song for an Underworld movie, and they were like, I don't think that's gonna work for the movie. But him and his manager called me up, and they're like, why don't you just go down to Austin and just write for, I think it was like 10 days. And we came up with a lot of great stuff, you know, and it was beautiful. Like, him and his wife were so super kind. Like, man, I mean, and they have this beautiful place. I mean, I think they've sold that by now, but it was pretty freaking epic. It was like a Tuscan, you know, mansion, you know, and had,
that's right, we were talking about this. It was like something out of Scarface, right?
Oh my god. I mean, you know, the saltwater freaking pool with the jacuzzi and the whole thing, man. And you know, you can imagine what David Draymond's houses look like. They were super nice to me, and we knocked it out, you know, like, and I think it was 2 10-day sessions that we did all the premium materia, and then we brought it out, and Ben Gross, who owns the mix room, so I'm at the mix room north, but the mix room south is where we did it, and I wouldn't call it south, but the original mix room that is over in Burbank, that was, you know, the place where we mixed it, and you know, of course Ben did his magic on it, and that was a great record.
Yeah, dude. I love all, you know, I love the flow of the tracks, but yeah, I always go back to that Glenn Hughes track, man. I think that is just one of the most, I don't know, for me, one of the most powerful moments on the record. Just his voice. I mean, getting him on that record, was that a David decision to make that happen, or?
It was. David did a lot of that heavy lifting. You know, I was working on the production stuff, you know, and like, but he had a vision to like bring in all these different folks, and you know, that all that credit goes to him.
Yeah,
you know, and he you know, he pulled him in, and yeah, that song's nuts,
like, dude. Just I mean, I can only imagine how many you could probably count on one hand how many takes you would have needed to do with Glenn to get those vocals, because I imagine he's just such a weapon on the microphone.
Yeah, I you know, I wasn't actually at that session. They did that remotely,
right?
Somewhere else.
Mm.
And but, you know, I was just happy that he was digging the track, because the track gets kind of crazy. You know, through it all starts out real drab. You know, like chunking away.
Yeah,
and then it gets super hyper at the end.
I think it's just such a beautiful finale track.
Yeah, you know, doesn't suck.
Yeah, I mean, it's a real moment in time musically. And yeah, absolutely. You've got every reason to feel proud of that record. It's just such a, I don't know, just such a great album to listen to over and over.
Thanks, man. I mean, you know, we worked super hard on that. You know, it was a whole experience, you know, like talk about records being snapshots in time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
That was a snapshot in time. And there was a lot going on with the both of us emotionally. But I think we rocked it, you know?
Yeah, you definitely did, man. And you totally deny that Dave played racquetball. I get it. That's fine.
David would be abhorred. Like, he'd be freaked out.
Yeah,
he never did that.
No, but
that was just a silly joke.
No. I totally roll with that. But no, I guess what I was going to ask you more of, like, he's such a lovely guy, but did you just have a bit of fun, you know, outside of the studio? Like, just, you know.
Yeah. I mean, we hung out. We had a lot of great dinners. Like,
yeah.
He's a foodie like I am.
Right.
Man, we had a lot of great food.
Oh, cool.
And his wife can cook like a ninja. So, you know.
That's amazing.
Yeah, no, it was great.
And you're a bit of a foodie, eh? So, yeah. So you like international cuisines, or do you have a particular go-to?
I mean, if I can go back to Vegemite, that might be my go-to.
I think so, man. I think so. You really can't go past that, can you?
No, I mean, it's Gino Leonardo. I mean, what do you think? Italian yeah, and French food are probably my faves right out of the gate. But I mean, there's a lot of great, you know, man, I love a good ramen.
Yeah, ramen rules, right?
Ramen totally rules.
Yeah. So I won't hold you up for too much longer, man, because you got stuff on. But last conversation.
Mixing tonight.
Yeah, man. But last conversation, you were telling me you'd done some work on a music for a whale documentary. I believe it was for Nat Geo or something like that.
Yeah. Well, it's not Nat Geo. I mean, it's still trying to be sold. But
there's
a whale, very famous whale, that was on Colbert, Valdemir.
Yeah.
Valdemir is trapped in a harbor. And I don't know if he's trapped. He could probably just swim away, whatever. But he loves this little harbor. And a filmmaker friend of mine that I did a film called Teenage Dirtbag for, she is over there. And she's caretaking the whale. And, like, they're trying to, you know, the whale, like, is getting cut up by propellers and all this stuff. So I just jumped in on the project, you know, and it's tentatively called Spy Whale because they found the whale with a harness on it that held a camera, and it said property of St. Petersburg. Oh, so it's like a Russian whale that they sent over to spy on Norway or whatever. So, you know, it's not just a strict documentary that you'd see on National Geographic or whatever. It's going to, hopefully it'll be on Netflix or Disney Plus or both. But essentially, I'm kind of, you know, helping save a whale.
I think that's brilliant, man. That's brilliant. And, and lastly, you recently, worked on a cover of Come Together for Ukrainian.
Yeah, relief. It was for Ukrainian.
God, yeah,
I mean, that. But Ukrainian relief. Track. John Fryer, who worked with Depeche Mode and Cocteau Twins and stuff, called me up and he's like, "We're doing this cover. You know, can you pitch in?" And I'm like, "Absolutely." So I did guitars on that, and Richard from Rammstein is on that, and a bunch of other great people. Chris Connolly, who was in Ministry.
Yeah.
He's singing on it. Julia Sanina, who is from, I think it's called The Hard Kiss. They're a Ukrainian rock band. She does a lovely job on it. And we're just trying to raise, you know, money. It's like those kind of things, like, you know, it's not for you. It's for them. And it all goes to UNICEF. So it I'm more proud of that than like kind of being on the Cyberpunk 2077 game. I mean, I'm proud of that too, and being on Peppermint with Jen Garner's film on Netflix and all that. But this kind of thing, it's like, it's so crazy right now with, you know, they're figuring out the war crimes and everything that's going on over there and has gone on and continues to go on. But I really feel for the children, you know, when you're a kid, you don't understand, like, if your parents are fighting or what the hell is going on, you know, like, or if you move from one house to another, when you're that young, you don't totally get it, but it does have an impact that is a lasting impact. So UNICEF is really great with helping children, you know, and it's as simplistic as getting food and toys to them or whatever. But I think, you know, dealing with the lasting psychological impact of what this totally ridiculously wrong war has done to these kids, these displaced children, it's just, you know, you do what you can do. I mean, yeah. I donated before that, but when I was asked to do it, I was like, this is, you know, what can I do to blow this up even more?
Yeah, absolutely. You know? I think it's a great thing, man. It's and yeah, I mean, and like I said, man, I heard the track and it's brilliant track. I mean, you know, I think it's appropriate and yeah, hopefully it does good things.
I sincerely hope so.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Absolutely. Well, man, it could talk to you forever, mate, but
I know we're at like 47 minutes.
Yeah, we're doing all right. But Gino, thanks so much for your time, man. I really appreciate it. And you're always welcome on this platform, man. It's yeah, we can talk
Vegemite. Thank you. Our first one, although it was recorded not as well, like it was a little more fun. Like we were like, you know, this is a little more serious and like,
yeah,
but you know, I hope people dig it and you know, and
I think so,
you know,
yeah. I think, you know, if we do a follow-up, we can devote it to, you know, Sexual Dynamite and Vegemite.
We can definitely get some Sexual Dynamite going.
I think we were even talking about Simon Le Bon at one point, a cat or something.
Oh,
like
that was, well, no, I had a llama, Simon Le Bon.
That's right, because he had property in Australia. Yes. Yeah, that was super cool, man. So, yeah, I love that you named the llama Simon Le Bon.
That's so cool. Yeah. Oh, man. And somebody, one of my friends told him that, and he's like, that's brilliant.
Oh, I love it, man. That's so cool. Well,
awesome stuff.
Gino, thanks so much for your time. Enjoy your Vegemite sandwich. I'll send you some Vegemite, mate.
It's definitely better than In-N-Out Burger.
Yeah, dude. It definitely goes in and it most definitely comes out.
Oh, no.
Yeah, that's evil. Pure
evil.
Yeah.
All right, man.
You have a good one, Gino. And right, thanks too. Again. All right. Man.
Thank you.
Peace. See ya.
Bye.
And that was a whole lot of Vegemite fun. That was my chat with Gino Lenardo. Big thanks to Gino for taking the time to redo this episode. I'm so glad we got it this time. That was a lot of fun. Hope you enjoyed the episode as much as I enjoyed creating it. If you enjoyed this episode and you want to hear others like it, whatever platform you listen to, make sure you hit that subscribe button and go one step further and hit the bell. That way you get notified when new episodes are up. New episodes of Happy Days out every Wednesday morning from 8 a.m. Queensland, Australian time. I think it's like Tuesday night in everywhere else in the world, depending where you are from. And of course, tune in. Every Friday, we have Freaky Fridays, my new podcast, horror podcast, where I talk to my writer friend, Jake Reedy. We talk more or less shit talk, all things horror, comic books, video games, movies, and it's a lot of fun, man, so strap in for that one. And of course, Saturday mornings are not complete without listening to Rad every Saturday morning from 8 a.m. It's kind of like your Saturday morning cartoons when you're a kid. But nothing like it because you got Jake Reedy and myself talking all things pop culture of the best of the 80s and the 90s. It's a good time, man. So this week's episode is good. We're going to be talking about the movie Airheads and An Ugly Kid Joe. What can possibly go wrong, right? So yeah, check it out. But again, thank you for tuning in and listening to this episode. Thanks so much again to Gino. What a guy. I really cannot wait to do a follow-up episode with him and talk about Vegemite some more because I'm going to send him some Vegemite and I really want to know what he thinks about it. But yeah, man, thanks for hanging around and look forward to having you back here next week. Same time, same channel. And thanks so much for your support. Again, go that one step further. Hit the subscribe and also support my creative journey at www.freekproductions.com. That's www.freekproductions.com. Go there and support my creative journey. Hope to see some of you at Supernova this weekend. I'll be in Artist Alley as well as doing a panel talk 10:30 in the morning on Saturday talking about the evolution of Freak Productions as well as my Freakenstein comics and everything else. Have yourselves a great week and stay happy, and drop me a line sometime. Thanks for tuning in. I've been Jesse. You've been amazing. Stay happy.